couple of days later, I was on the plane to California. Before the show, Johnny Carson came by the room where I was waiting and said hello, something he almost never did. I guess he knew I had to be hurting and wanted to put me at ease. I was slated to come on stage shortly after the show started, and Carson began by telling the audience not to worry about my appearance because, quote, we've got plenty of coffee and extra cots in the lobby. He then introduced me, and introduced me, and introduced me. He dragged it out forever by telling everything his researchers could find out about Arkansas. I thought he was going to take longer than I did in Atlanta. When I finally came out and sat down, Carson took out a huge hourglass and put it down next to me so that the whole world could see the sand running down. This performance would be time-limited. It was hilarious. Carson asked me what had happened in Atlanta. I told him I had wanted to make Mike Dukakis, who wasn't known for his oratorical skills, look good. And, quote, I succeeded beyond my wildest imagination. I told him Dukakis liked the speech so much that he wanted me to go to the Republican convention to nominate Vice President Bush, too. Then I claimed I'd blown the speech on purpose because, quote, I always wanted to be on this show in the worst way, and now I am. Johnny then asked if I thought I had a political future. I deadpanned an answer. It depends on how I do on this show tonight. After we traded one-liners for a few minutes and got good laughs from the studio audience, Johnny invited me to play the sax with Doc Severinsen's band. We did an upbeat version of Summertime, which went over at least as well as the jokes. After it was over, I was relieved and thought it had gone about as well as possible. I took a red-eye flight home. The next day, I learned that the Carson Show had earned good ratings nationwide and astronomical ones in Arkansas. When I walked into the state capitol, a hometown crowd was there to clap, cheer, and hug me for my performance. At least in Arkansas, the Carson Show had put the Atlanta debacle behind me. Things seemed to be looking up for me and the rest of America, too. CNN named me the political winner of the week after dubbing me its big loser just the week before. Tom Shales said that I had, quote, recovered miraculously, and that people who watch television love this kind of comeback story. Unfortunately, things weren't going so well for Mike Dukakis. George Bush had given a marvelous acceptance speech at his convention, offering a kinder, gentler Reaganism, and telling us to, quote, read my lips, no new taxes. Moreover, the vice president's kinder, gentler approach didn't extend to Mike Dukakis. Lee Atwater and company went after him like a pack of rabid dogs, saying Mike didn't believe in pledging allegiance to the flag or being tough on criminals. An allegedly independent group with no overt ties to the Bush campaign ran an ad featuring a convicted killer named Willie Horton, who had been released on a Massachusetts prison furlough program. Not coincidentally, Horton was black. His opponents were performing reverse plastic surgery on Dukakis, who didn't help himself by not responding quickly and vigorously to the attacks. Dukakis found his voice in the last 3 weeks of the campaign, but he never recovered the New Democrat image that the negative ads and his insufficiently aggressive debate performance had destroyed. In November, Vice President Bush defeated him 54-46%. We didn't carry Arkansas either, though I tried. Dukakis was a good man and a fine governor. He and Lloyd Benson would have served our country well in the White House. But the Republicans had defined him right out of the race. I couldn't blame them for sticking with a strategy that worked, but I didn't think it was good for America. In mid-September of 1990, at the height of my last campaign for governor, a disgruntled former employee of the Development Finance Authority, who had been fired for making more than 120 phone calls from his office to conservative supporters of the Nicaraguan Contras, called a press conference on the steps of the state capitol and accused me of using the finance agency's funds to carry on affairs with five women. I drove into my parking space in front of the capitol and was hit cold with a story by Bill Simmons of the Associated Press, a senior member of the political press and a good reporter. When Simmons asked me about the charges, I just suggested he call the women. He did, they all denied it, and the story basically died. None of the television stations or newspapers ran it. At the end of the campaign, my opponent, former utility executive Sheffield Nelson, put on a television ad that was misleading but effective. The announcer raised a series of issues and asked what I would do about them. To each question, my own voice answered, "Raise and spend." Nelson's campaign had lifted those three words from a section in my State of the State address, in which I compared Arkansas's budget with that of the federal government. While Washington could engage in deficit spending, if we didn't have any money, we had to, quote, raise and spend, or not spend at all. I put out a response ad comparing Nelson's claim to what I had really said, and told the voters that if they couldn't trust Nelson not to mislead them in the campaign, they couldn't trust him to be governor. A couple of days later, I was reelected, 57-43%. Earlier in the year, I had become chairman of the Democratic Leadership Council, a group of centrist Democrats who believed our party would never win national elections again until we offered the American people new ideas rooted in mainstream values. In December, I resumed my work for the DLC, launching the Texas chapter in Austin. In my speech there, I argued that our government was spending too much on yesterday and today, on interest on the debt, defense, more money for the same health care, and spending too little on tomorrow, on education, the environment, research and development, the infrastructure. I said the DLC stood for a modern, mainstream agenda, the expansion of opportunity, not bureaucracy, choice in public schools and child care, responsibility and empowerment for poor people, and reinventing government away from the top-down bureaucracy of the industrial era to a leaner, more flexible, more innovative model appropriate for the modern global economy. At this time, I was trying to develop a national message for the Democrats, and the effort fueled speculation that I might enter the presidential race in 1992. During the recent campaign, I had said on more than one occasion that I would serve out my term if elected. That's what I thought I would do. I was excited about the coming legislative session, though I strongly disagreed with many of his decisions, like killing the Brady Bill and vetoing the Family and Medical Leave Act. I also liked President Bush and had a good relationship with the White House. And finally, a campaign to defeat him looked hopeless. Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, and the United States was beginning its buildup for the Gulf War, which in 2 months would drive the president's approval ratings into the stratosphere. During the 1991 legislative session, the state legislature passed the National Rifle Association's bill to prohibit cities and counties from adopting local gun control ordinances, the same measure I had vetoed in 1989. No Southern legislature could say no to the NRA. Even in the more liberal Senate, this bill passed 26-7. At least I got the Senate to pass it late so I could veto it after they went home, and there could be no attempt to override it. After the bill was sent to me, I had an extraordinary encounter with a young NRA lobbyist who came down from Washington to push the bill. He was very tall and well-dressed and spoke with a clipped New England accent. One day he stopped me as I was crossing the rotunda from the House to the Senate side of the Capitol. "Governor, Governor, why don't you just let this bill become law without your signature?" I explained for the umpteenth time why I didn't support the bill. Then he burst out, "Look, Governor, you're going to run for president next year, and when you do, we're going to beat your brains out in Texas if you veto this bill." I knew I was getting older and more seasoned when I didn't slug him. Instead, I just smiled and said, "You don't get it. I don't like this bill. You know gun control will never be a problem in Arkansas. You've just got a chart on the wall in your fancy office in Washington with this bill at the top and all the states listed below. You don't give a damn about the merits of this bill. You just want to put a check by Arkansas on that chart. So you get your gun and I'll get mine. We'll saddle up and meet in Texas." As soon as the legislature went home, I vetoed the bill. Soon afterward, the NRA began running television ads attacking me. It wasn't until I began writing this account that I realized that in my confrontation with the NRA lobbyist, I had acknowledged that I was considering running for president. At the time, I didn't think there was a chance I'd do it. I just didn't like to be threatened. One July day back in Arkansas, I was told that President Bush's policy advisor, Roger Porter, wanted to talk to me. I had worked with Roger on the Education Goals Project and had a high regard for his ability both to be loyal to the president and still work with the governors. Roger asked me if I was going to run for president in 1992. I told him I hadn't decided, that I was happier being governor than I'd been in years, that my family life was good and I was reluctant to disrupt it, but that I thought the White House was being too passive in dealing with the country's economic and social problems. I said I thought the president should use the enormous political capital he had as a result of the Gulf War victory to tackle the country's big issues. After 5 or 10 minutes of what I thought was a serious conversation, Roger cut it off and got to the point. I'll never forget the words of the message he had been designated to deliver. "Cut the crap, Governor." He said they had reviewed all the potential candidates against the president. Governor Cuomo was the most powerful speaker, but they could paint him as too liberal. All the senators could be defeated by attacks on their voting records. But I was different. With a strong record in economic development, education, and crime, and a strong DLC message, I actually had a chance to win. So if I ran, they would have to destroy me personally, "Here's how Washington works," he said. "The press has to have somebody in every election, and we're going to give them you." He went on to say the press were elitist who would believe anything they were told about backwater Arkansas. "We'll spend whatever we have to spend to get whoever we have to get to say whatever they have to say to take you out. And we'll do it early." I tried to stay calm, but I was mad. I told Roger that what he had just said showed what was wrong with the administration. They had been in power so long they thought they were entitled to it. I said, "You think those parking spaces off the West Wing are yours, but they belong to the American people, and you have to earn the right to use them." I told Roger that what he had said made me more likely to run. Roger said that was a nice sentiment, but he was calling as my friend to give me fair warning. If I waited until 1996, I could win the presidency. If I ran in 1992, they would destroy me, and my political career would be over.